Just a quick warning, this podcast series contains discussions about crime, trauma, sexual abuse, drug use, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised.
Loretta Lyon is a survivor of human trafficking. I ask you to tune in and listen to this story. If you're not inspired by her story, nothing will inspire you. Loretta Lyon, welcome to the Stick Up Podcast. It's been a journey.
It has been a journey. Thanks for having me, Russell. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I first watched your podcast. And I'm a big fan of James English. Shout out to James English. And I first saw that and, man, I was touched. I thought, you know, I've got a survivor story myself, but, I just thought your story made mine look like a fairy tale, basically. So thanks for joining us, and we really appreciate you taking your time out to tell your story.
Thank you, Russell. But please, can I just say something? You can't say your story is a fairy tale. I think all stories are not to be compared, because I think, I know the way you're saying it, you're being humble about it. I'm sure your journey was just extraordinary. But I think pain is pain.
Yeah.
So if listeners are listening and they're thinking, well, if Russell is saying his story was fairy tale, then what is mine? Every story is very important. So no matter how small you might think it is, I think it's what shapes you, what teaches you lessons. So I think, in a way, listeners should just focus on what they're going through after listening to us talk today and take that in and just say, what is it teaching me, rather than what is it taught her or him?
Yeah.
You know, because we can share our lessons, but for sure, it's for the listeners to get their lessons from their life experience. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't compare. Nobody's in competition here. But the more we share, the more we open up. I think the most vulnerable you can become, the stronger you become.
Yeah.
Because vulnerability.
I'm a big fan of that. My real strength comes from learning to be vulnerable. And so I relate that. I'd like to start with every interview. Where'd you grow up? What was your upbringing like? You know, what school? Let's talk about that.
Oh, my God. I'd love to take the people on this journey, because I think these were, besides now, what I've created so far since I've made it to the UK, prior to that, this was my last kind of memories that I cherish and the memories that kept me going. I grew up, initially I was born in, it was Yugoslavia once. People probably don't remember Yugoslavia, but there is lots of Yugoslavian, ex-Yugoslavian people living in Australia. I've had loads of them contact me already. And so our country just went through war and ended up splitting up into all different countries, which we know now, Croatia, you've got Montenegro, Kosovo, which is still not sort of recognized as a country, but it is there. Serbia, did I mention Macedonia? Nope. No. Macedonia, Croatia, Slovenia, so Bosnia, it's really complicated. But when I was born, it was still Yugoslavia, which was great because it was that sense of one of the only countries from communist countries that was actually had the freedom to travel to European countries, which was quite unique. And hence why my dad, my mom ended up in Yugoslavia studying. My mom was she was becoming a professor of languages, of local languages in Yugoslavia. And my dad was doing research in medicine. So they met, fell in love, decided to live in Yugoslavia, which then ended up being Serbia, where they settled down. It's where I grew up. But unfortunately, it wasn't very peaceful. Initially, it was really great. We were very humble in a way that we were very poor. Even though my dad was a doctor, he struggled to find a job. And in the book, I do explain why he struggled to find a job or get a job. And my mom, because they were such big activists in human rights. And to be an activist in human rights in a country that's known to be very communist and corrupt at so many levels, it meant that you were then the black sheep. And therefore, my dad was denied so many roles as a doctor. But eventually, things settled down. He did get a role as a doctor. And just very poor. But I was so rich in love and respect. And I was the only child. I still am the only child. And at school, it was incredible. I mean, I never had this pressure from my parents. They never really asked me to go and make them proud or anything, but it was in my DNA to do well, because I realized how much they tried to to provide for me and to give me some kind of comfort.
What was your aspirations as a kid? What did you want to grow up to be?
Yeah, that's actually, it comes up on the book as well. My dad asked me just before the war really broke up down south where I grew up. My dad said, just out of curiosity, he said, "What is it that you aspire to be when you grow up, Loretta?" And I looked at him, having watched the way he has been with people working as a doctor. I said, "Actually, Dad, I'd love to be a doctor just like you."
Yeah.
And he actually looked at me, he's like, "Doctor, really? Why?" It wasn't just a role for him, it was a passion, what he did. I said, "It's nothing to do with, you know, how much money you earn, because you clearly don't earn much." But I said, it was about helping people like you do. And then he left me with a sentence, which only really hit home for me when I came to the UK and I started doing business. He said to me, "Listen," he said, "if helping people is what you want, just remember this," so "you will always find a way to help. You don't have to be a doctor."
Mm.
And as a kid, I was like, "Oh my God, my dad is just not believing in me. Maybe I'm not a good student enough," but I was excellent. But I thought he doubted my knowledge.
Mm.
But no, he was actually preparing me for the fact that I was never to go to university because the war was ticking like a ticking bomb.
Mm.
And he was quite right. I never ended up at university back home. I was running for my life.
Mm.
So I wanted to be a doctor and help people, and here I am.
Here it is. I've always said, you know, that's what I based my whole change in my life. When I decided, you know, I was going to be of service to others, I was never going to be lost, you know. And the universe has looked after me, you know. I've never always had food in my stomach and a roof over my head with the, you know, the aim of the game for me to be of service to others. So I get it. I get that. I love seeing kids with that attitude, you know, wanting to help people. Like, that's a good kid. There's an indicator. There's a lot of empathy and compassion in that child. And it's going to bode well for them in the future with that sort of attitude towards life.
I think that's really learned, because a lot of things I have kids, and I always say to my kids, look, you can learn a lot of stuff at school, but the initial learning, it's the education that you get from a family, if possible, if a child has that family, whether it's by birth or not, it doesn't matter. If you can get that kind of education of treating others right, always thinking of helping, you know, laying a helping hand to neighbors, to this, that's how you start.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I started doing that, actually. Just even nowadays, my dad always says, "Oh, people always ask of you, even the elderly, they remember you as a kid, grabbing their bags and helping them from shopping." And it was just something, I didn't do it for recognition. I just did it because it made me feel good. And I wanted to make people smile, you know. I was capable, so I would help. So if you're capable in helping.
It's so good for the spirit.
So good for you, you know, do things that makes you feel, do it for yourself. I always say, if you're going to help someone, don't do it for the sake of being recognized. It doesn't matter. Nobody will remember you for that. But they will remember you how you made them feel and how you made yourself feel. True. So it's very important how you make yourself feel.
For sure. What was the big change? What happened?
It was one of those things that you just switch a light and everything just changes, you know, the light switch. And war hit us quite badly.
Were you seeing, was there bombings and that sort of going around you? Were you close to it?
Yeah, so it was loads of bombing happening because, I mean, we live just on the border with Kosovo. Mm. It's right on the crease of the mountains. Mm. And beyond our village, there was no more villages that will connect from Serbia to Kosovo. It was literally us and then the border and then Kosovo. Mm. So the Serbian army started bombing Kosovo. It was just a nightmare, and bombing us as well. And the reason they bombed our town was because majority of our town was Albanian speaking and Muslim.
Yeah.
And so it became a bit religious rather than, and also obviously because the majority of the Serbian people, they speak Serbian. Mm. Even in Bosnia, though they're Muslims, they still speak Serbian. It's very complicated, kind of that side of the world. It's super complicated. Only people that are from there will understand the depth of complication of it. But because this was a town, the biggest town, 100% spoke Albanian, and they were all Muslims, So the Serbs decided to do the biggest massacre there's ever been, bigger than the one they did in Bosnia, which is a very well heard of, like a very well known massacre that happened in Bosnia, and well, also in Kosovo, but Bosnia was massive. And so we got marched to the crease of the mountains.
When you say got marched, who marched? The army?
It was the army. Yeah. They, after a lot of bombing and push and pull kind of.
What was it, your own army or the Serbian army?
Our own army.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they just came in, got everybody out of the houses and started marching us. Because the town is, or the village is sort of placed around this crease of the mountains. So it's sort of like a valley and then all mountains and then it leads into the... As you go deeper into the mountain, opens up into a big field, and that's where they were leading us. And just
for safety, they were leading you there for your safety.
No, they were taking us to massacre us.
Yeah,
yeah, to shoot us all to make the biggest massacre that's ever been.
Yeah,
to prove a point, and their point was they wanted to prove a point with the United Nations. Because by that point, United Nations had interfered with the war in Kosovo and Serbia, and there were the peacekeepers already in place. I don't know if you remember this, or I don't know if you had access to this kind of news then, but Serbians got really upset and they said, okay, well, if NATO is entering Kosovo, that's still our land that we're fighting to keep, because the Kosovans wanted to separate from Serbia. For also a very good reason, actually, because I explain things in the book. It was horrendous what happened to the Kosovan people during this time. I mean, people had to go to join the army, and this is a long story, but the Kosovans also had to participate. It was compulsory. You had to go to the army. But then what happened was majority of these people that went to serve the Serbian army, they wouldn't return alive. They were returning in closed caskets, and then asked not to open them up. Only took one mother, actually, after her son got buried and the army left. She said, let's go back to the grave, open up the grave. And this is a Kosovo mother. They open up the grave to find a body that's been cut into a T shape, and all the organs were gone. So they were killing the Kosovans that were joining the Serbian army, because it was all one country, so they had to join the army. And so Kosovo, and then they started
taking... And harvesting their organs? Is that what they were doing?
They were cutting them open and taking the organs. So the mother never opened up the kid, but she assumed it was all over the news, actually. This is early in the 90s. And this is when the conflict actually started with Kosovo and Serbia. It gets so complicated. But I think there is good and bad in every culture, every religion. And it's just, it went too far. We fought each other and it got really messy.
I had a friend that was in the war, and she was saying to me that when it kicked off, your friend across the road now becomes your enemy. The person that you waved to at the mailbox of a morning said good morning, and that word fucking, you know.
Shooting you down.
Yeah.
She's right. That's exactly what it was, because our village was all Albanian speaking. My family speaks both languages because it's what we learned at school. I was going to a school that was Albanian and Serbian, and the next town was mixed of Albanian Serbians, and that town turned against the Serbs turned against the Albanian speaking. It was horrific. It's like your neighbor fighting you. It's that kind of scenario. It was really bad. But yeah, that massacre that never happened, I say, we got marched into the crease of the mountain, and then my uncle, he was a really wealthy man. He decided to bribe the army with all of his wealth just to save the town. And it was quite an emotional night and scary, actually. I was clinging on to my mom for dear life and kids screaming.
As children, did you just have an idea what was going to happen?
We knew that it wasn't good.
Yeah.
We didn't exactly know. I mean, I was in my teens, so I was a bit more aware what was going on, but the little ones were just crying and screaming because it was cold and... And they didn't understand what's happening. Why are we in this field, in the crease of the mountain? So we weren't allowed to talk anyway. We were just whispering to each other. And so our family stayed together. My uncle, my dad, my mom, my uncle's wife, his son, and I, we were all sort of cooped up together. And my uncle turned to my dad. He said, "Oh, brother, you look after the family. I'm going to negotiate." And my dad, you know, logic, doctor, he's like, "Stay, brother." He's like, "No, no, watch this." So he goes and he calls the army. He's like, "Hey, you." Mm-hmm. it's like a John Wayne. And he walked like John Wayne. I miss him so much. He bribed the army. He said, "Look, if you do the massacre that you are intending to do, you will be hunted down. Once everything calms down, they will hunt you down and send you to Hague. Don't do this. The town hasn't done anything. Just free them. I'll give you so much wealth. Just run. You guys run. I'll give you the wealth." So he negotiated with them, and they thought he was bluffing. So they actually decided to test my uncle. And they left a few of the soldiers behind with a whole crowd. We were in the thousands, big town. My mom volunteered and literally just sort of slipped off my hands. She's like, "I'll come with you to my uncle. This is my dad's brother." And I'm like, "Mom, what?" She's like, "No, don't worry. I'll go help your uncle." She's so like such a warrior, that woman. So she went and helped my uncle, because all the wealth that my uncle had, it was actually in the ground, because he didn't trust banks. There was so much corruption. So he had gold and cash all put in his ground, in the garden, all these different holes. So he was there with my mom and the soldiers digging. I mean, I didn't see them digging, but they gave all the wealth. And then all of a sudden, almost an hour or so went by. We weren't allowed to move. The soldiers started disappearing. And they said, "Just wait here, don't move." So we waited as long as we could, the whole town, without supervision of any army. So they all disappeared. So we decided to make a move and walk down and see what's happening. I, on the other side, and my dad and my uncle's wife with her son, we were actually crying, because we thought, they didn't come back. So what happened to them? Did they kill them? So we were waiting to see the worst. But when we entered the garden, it was such a, I will never forget it. So it was such a surprise to see my mom and my uncle crying, sitting there on the stairs of my uncle's house, thinking that the massacre happened anyway, even though the wealth has gone. And my uncle was devastated. But when he heard us come into the garden, that was tears of joy and lots of hugs, as if we haven't seen each other for years, is that longing and the relief that, "Oh my God, it didn't happen. Thank God for this. I managed to save the town."
He was a saint, your uncle, wasn't he? But I think he grasped the concept that you can't take it with you when you're gone, as in regards to the material, you know. So it was worthless to him anyway.
You know, Russell, he died soon after that.
Did he?
He died soon after that, and he was so devastating. When he died, I still happened to be there before I had to run for my life. This is within days, believe it or not, within days after this, the whole town stood up to bury him. To this day, he's really remembered like the hero.
Yeah, so he should
And
be.
He didn't take anything with him.
Yeah.
So he, you know, clearly it just comes to show we don't take anything with us.
Yeah.
Like I said at the beginning, you know, it's like people will remember you how you made them feel.
Well, he left a legacy of
He really has done.
He left a legacy of yourself. Look at the beautiful person you are.
Thank you. He was like my second dad, because they didn't have a kid for a long time. So I grew up with him and his wife in the house while my mom and dad worked. So she looked after me. And, you know, I used to call her mom as well. So mom number one, mom number two.
Yeah.
And then I started calling her Gigi, which means like an auntie.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I owe it, you know, to raise a child. Sometimes it takes a whole town and a whole village. And
so what happened to you after that? Did you return back to your houses in your town?
We all returned. It was this feeling of like, as if someone has died, you know. We were so confused that I think our adrenaline had gone so high, and then that drop off sense of relief, but it left us all puzzled.
Because you didn't know if it was still going to happen, did
you? No, we didn't.
Fear's a bad master.
Oh, God. But yeah, you know, things happen. And then, you know, my uncle passed away. The town buried him. And then we started getting terrorized by the army again. They were abusing the women, raping and doing all of the what they shouldn't be doing.
Mm.
And I think this was the turning point for my life. It never was. Obviously, that night was really significant. But personally, fighting every step of the way till I got to the UK, it was that's when it started. That one day, my dad coming back from the village and he's like, pack, go. And I'm like, where am I going?
How old were you at the stage?
I was in my teens. So I was... I think I had to literally ask my mum and my dad to give me some. I've lost track of time, Russell, because I was held for so long in a dark room. Yeah. So I was 18, turning 18 when this happened. I think my birthday happened when I was on the run.
And where did they, when they say run, where was the destination they wanted you to run to?
So in Kosovo, they had the United Nations already on the ground. Yeah. And according to my dad, what he thought was right is if I cross the mountain and I got to the other side of Kosovo, because you couldn't cross legally, they barricaded by the Serbs, and on the other side was by either the local army or the United Nations that were guarding it. So nobody was allowed to leave or enter anywhere. We were like in a frying pan. So I had to go through the mountains and sneak through, literally to the other side. I didn't know where I was going. I mean, I didn't have a compass. I listened to my dad. I mean, it's a long story, a lot of debate with my dad. I didn't want to go, in all fairness. I wanted at least my mum with me. I was so scared. But I never have spoken back to my parents, and I decided that I would never speak back to them. So their wish was my doing whatever they said I had to do. I thought, it was for the good. And so did my dad. So I crossed the mountain and I ended up in Kosovo eventually after like hours and hours of trekking and getting lost and thinking, oh, what am I here? It was just horrendous that trekking through those mountains was crazy. But ended up with a lot of help. Like I got on the bus, local buses there, and I speak Albanian fluently and with all the dialects. So they couldn't tell that I was from Serbia. And I put on my dialect. I said, I need to get to Pristina, which was the capital of Kosovo, because that's where the NATO was based. So my dad said, whatever you do, just get to the capital. And from there, ask for either Red Cross or camps where they're holding people that are homeless or refugees. I said, okay, Dad, I'll do that. So I got to Pristina, but by the time I reached Pristina, it was nighttime and it was dark and scary and again, very cold. I ended up in this bar. It was the only thing that I saw open. I walked in and I remember it like today. I opened the door and as I walked in, all I could see was uniform, police officers with different color uniform, army. And I'm looking around. I don't recognize any of the uniforms. And they were all United Nations. So the police officers from United Nations, they had this really dark navy blue uniform with blue helmets. And then each nation had their own flag so to be identified which nation is it. And I didn't really make any contact with anyone. I just asked the barman for water because I was so thirsty. And he looked at me. I mean, I was, obviously I looked underage. I was just turning 18. So he looked at me like, what are you doing here? He gave me water, didn't speak to him much. I went outside and I sat down at the door outside because I started panicking. Where do I go? I don't know where to go. Panicking. And I actually, I was getting very tearful and panic has set in. Lo and behold, two UN police officers came out with a translator that they had the whole time. And they came out and they're like, what are you doing on the streets? So the translator is speaking to me in Albanian. He said, where are you from and what are you doing on the streets? I said, I'm not from here. I'm from Serbia. And I've come here because we are being terrorized in such and such village. And he looked at me. He's like, you shouldn't be here. You're from Serbia. Why have you come here? You're not welcome. The translator. I said, just tell them, send me to the Red Cross, please, or any shelter because I need shelter. I'm on the streets. My dad asked me to do so. They said to the translator, tell her we can't send her there yet, but if she's on the streets and nowhere to go, we're happy to give her shelter initially, but she has to come with us. They were not my nation. nothing to do with my religion. So they completely alien to me in a sense. And the reason I say that, because it made me realize that it doesn't matter. My own people were terrorizing us. And here I had two Americans, Christians, helping me. And it was really eye-opening, because what I was to witness with staying with them was really quite endearing. And I have done nothing more than long to constantly create that peace amongst all religions, all nations, because they showed me how it should be. They opened my eyes to, they educated me just by being them.
Yep.
They only told me why they didn't send me after I escaped and everything, after what happened to me. Most recently, actually, I had a chat with both of them, and I discovered that the reason they didn't send me to the Red Cross was not because of the Red Cross. It was because of the people, the local people running the Red Cross, and the corruption that was going on, and the human trafficking was massive. It started just before the war, and then it got really out of hand during the war. So there was gang on human trafficking that would take children, women, any gender, anyone that was healthy, men that were being, their organ taken away, so organ harvesting. It was just really quite, how can I say, like a horror kind of movie when you think of it. And I didn't know this. They just said, you can't go to the Red Cross. We can't take you to any shelters. You have to stay with us until hopefully war calms down in your town, and then you can go back. I actually didn't refuse much because I was comfortable. I was safe. They respected me. They gave me the living room to live there. There was a sofa there. When they were at work, I was washing the uniforms, often by hands because they didn't have electricity. So hand washing the uniform, not that they asked me. I have to say this, they never asked me to do anything, but just out of respect, I wanted to show them that I'm living here and the least I can do to show you that I really appreciate what you're doing for me. They were giving me food and they were looking after me like a family member. So we became the best friends, the three musketeers. And so in the evenings when they finished their, when they finished their day at work, they would take me to their colleagues' apartments, and they would have a couple of drinks, talk, and watch something on TV, some games, some American stuff. And I was always with them. I was like their kid, because one of them had kids. So he treated me like his child. And Brian didn't have any children, but it didn't stop them from seeing me as this innocent kid that needed safety.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should continue, but
yeah, please do. This is what,
Then what happened, Russell, was that the translator that was translating for them, I didn't know it then, but we discovered it later. He literally went and told the locals, especially the gangs, that there is a young girl staying with the Americans and it's a potential for human trafficking. And he actually told them I was a spy because I'm from Serbia. So when I, this one day, I made a mistake and I stand by it. It was my own mistake. I had done all the chores around the house, and just outside the, of their apartment, they lived on the ground floor. It was this stand where they would sell magazines and newspapers. And I had a bit of change. And they always said, take the change if you ever need it. You know, when we go to the shops, you can buy something for yourself. Buy a magazine, just read it, because nothing to do, no electricity. And as I walked out, I left even the door open. I didn't even shut it or anything. I just left it on the locker so it doesn't shut, so I can buy the magazine and come home. It was so nearby. I didn't realize that the apartment was being watched by the human trafficking gangs. As I walked out on the pavement, this big kind of people carrier, like a truck. I say a truck, it's a people carrier, black, and it just pulls in front of me. And what went through my mind then was, what are they doing on the pavement? You know, it's, you know, the car shouldn't be on the pavement. I was so naive. I was about to tell them off. I didn't have a chance really to speak. They just came out, slided the doors open, came out, and it was so fast. It was like a split second. I was seeing everything, and it was all of a sudden pitch black. And they're saying, oh, we've got the spy, we've got, you know, they're swearing and I'm thinking, oh my God, if only I could wake up. You know, I thought I was having a dream. They didn't drive very long. It was very quickly, about 5 to 10 minutes, we were there. We reached this destination. I don't know. I didn't know where they've taken me. When I got out of the car, they dragged me in, put me on my knees, and they took this thing off my head. And when I opened my eyes, initially I was like, oh my God, just looking around where I was, really frightened. This guy, the boss, he was limping and sort of walking towards me. He said, oh, she's the one. You know, he was quite impressed. She's the one. And he started being quite sarcastic. He said, okay, boys, rape her. I want to watch. And all in Albanian, so I understand the language completely, fully. And I started screaming and crying instantly because I got flipped on my back from being on my knees and then just flipped. And everything I had on just got ripped off me. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was trembling and I could see what's happening. And I'm screaming, please don't do this. At the top of my lungs, I'm a virgin. Please don't do this. Please leave me. And the boss heard the actual word, I'm a virgin. And to him was like, I think he saw like the golden star or something. Mm. He's just like, boy, stop. He had to interfere to stop them. They got such a thrive to rape me that they were in a high. He had to literally get involved and say stop to the boys. He stopped them. He said, did you not hear? We stumbled across a huge cargo. She's a virgin. And I'm thinking, cargo, what does that mean? Huge cargo. I mean, I was a kid. I didn't understand. I thought cargo was, you know, goods and stuff. I didn't think a human is a cargo.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, right, let's go. He said, wrap her up. We've got work to do. So, because they needed to train me. So they wrapped me up, gave me some stuff to wear, and they left the building with me. And they didn't put a hoodie or anything on me at this point. So we walked back to the car. And when we walked out, I realized we were in the middle of Pristina. This was not a remote place. Mm. It was literally exactly where the hospitals are, not very far. So this building was massive and very significant. And then from there, we drove another 5 minutes and it was the safe house. So literally within all walking distance, not far from my police officers where they lived. And then the grooming process started, and the grooming process was really horrific. To have gone from an innocent kid, I never knew what kissing or doing these kind of sexual acts or intercourse meant or looked like. I was really so oblivious to the whole thing. So when they started grooming me, it was really hard to watch sexual acts live. It was horrific.
No, I'm making you watch other people having sex.
So the boss was having sex with his lover because there was a girl, the woman, I should say, that he had with her at all times. And she was very manipulative. I will never forget her face. She would come on to me and trying to be, you know, all like sexual with me. It revolted me because I was a kid. I genuinely speaking, I was really a kid. I was as innocent as a 10-year-old is today. And she was doing this act with him and I was made to watch. If I didn't watch, the gun was pointed at my head or at my ribs. The one time that I feel the most guilt about is, and I have said this in so many interviews, was when they brought this girl in. She was unconscious. And they put her in a room on the floor and they were raping her and they were making me watch. If I didn't watch, obviously I was threatened to be killed and just I was being manipulated. And watching this girl, someone else's kid, I couldn't do anything about it.
Wow.
How could people be so cruel?
Yeah.
And so I feel so sorry for her. Just I remember at the end they said, okay, discard her body. Discard her body? What do you mean? Like you just like do this, you kill these people?
I often think to myself, what's what happened to them people to be so desensitized to do that to other people? I think, I like to rewind and backtrack and I go, man, some, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not justifying them, but I just think, wow, where do you come from? You come from hell to take that approach to another human, but like.
Russell, such a good point that you made, because later on in my story, I will touch base on it quite quickly as well, but this is so true. It's exactly, I think, is exactly this thought that then started saving my sanity, you know? And that was later on when I got in a solitary confinement. But these people, the human trafficking, and those other people that what happens next, I always thought, what happened to these children? Because I see, initially when I meet people, I see them as kids, because kids are so innocent.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, life shapes them. What happened to these people that to have made them, to have triggered such evil, no compassion, there is no feelings, there is so much emptiness in them. How
can you do it?
You can't even hurt an animal like that.
You know, in Australia, the stats on child abusers, they say that 75% of child abusers were abused themselves. I don't think that's true. I don't think them stats are right.
I was abused. I'm not like that.
Yeah. Same with me. In my line of work, I've got 19,000 clients, abuse survivors. Not one of them has been ever convicted for abuse. So I think that's just a distorted statistic. But I'm always interested, like in the jails in Australia, we've got some prisoners that are extremely violent and they want to bash people and torture people and stuff like that. And I wonder what happened to you for you to be like that? You know what I mean? What happened? I'm not justifying it. I'm just interested in what act happened to you for you to have no empathy and compassion? Because it's that transference, isn't it? You know?
It really is. I mean, it's like I genuinely think even if something remotely like what we've been through happened to these people, whatever it might be, there is a choice that we make. I think maybe 100%. It is. It's a matter of choice. Mm. Do you then choose to heal and do the opposite? Because
we heal in love.
Yeah, you got to heal. Love is, I always say, love is the most highest frequency we can vibrate at.
Mm.
And I really try to practice love the whole time. Mm. And it's hard sometimes.
Oh, for sure. But, I struggle with it. I struggle after the abuse to allow people to love me. I do. I struggle with it every day. Like, I've got a girlfriend at the moment who just loves me to death and she's good at it. And I can't escape it. And I get this thing where I'm going, I'm trying to fight it off, but you know, I bet it's a healing process as well.
It is a healing process. And I think I can relate to that because my husband he never once has he ever given up on me.
Mm.
No matter what we've been through, in all fairness, as much as I don't like giving up on stuff, there's been times where I've said, I'm just so tired and I just don't want to do this anymore. Not in a sense that he's always been the one, no, babe, I believe you. I believe in you. I believe in us. And it's kept it going. So it's learning to love is one thing because we needed to heal ourselves.
Yeah.
But when someone loves us, it's like, we always question, I almost question it. It's like, why?
Yeah.
I'm still learning to understand why people love me because I've got shown so much hate and so much cruelty that it's very hard for me to accept it. It's almost like, oh, I'm not worthy of it. So I have to really had to change my mindset to say I'm worthy of this. And it started with having my kids to learning to accept the
That's
love.
That's a whole different level, isn't it?
Yeah. When they tell me, like, Mommy, I love, and I say, I love you guys. And the oldest one always says, I love you more. I'm like, it's impossible.
Mm.
He's like, no, really, Mommy, I love you more. I'm like, it's impossible.
Because I was on a plane.
It is.
I was on a plane from Dubai to London. And there was this little girl and this mum sitting there together. And she just said, Mommy, I just want to tell you something. Like, she'd flick the headphones off. And she goes, Mommy, I just love you. And I was just... such a beautiful thing to see, like a kid do that. You know what I mean? That innocence of a child that hasn't been tainted or damaged or anything like that, that just had unconditional love in them and projecting it into the world like that, you know. And then you look at kids that they get robbed from that by abusers and stuff like that. They just steal the biggest gift that their kids had.
Yeah.
Take it from underneath their tree.
We should learn from them so much. They are so pure.
Okay, let's progress on. What was the next step here?
Oh, the next step, to make the whole long story short, actually, guys, because it is very, very long and detailed. They got to the point where they thought I had enough training and I should be efficient enough to serve the highest bidder. So they had put me to the highest bidder and I got bought by someone. I never met my highest bidder. And I was meant to then, they were meant to send me to Albania, and that's where the transfer would happen to the rest of the whatever was meant to happen to me. During the process of going to the border with Albania, Kosovo, we had to stop a few times, and we reached the border eventually. The patrol at the border, it was Italian police officers actually guarding that border. They said the border is shut for today and we don't know when it's going to open, so we suggest to go back. The guys got really angry and they were holding guns at me, like, don't say anything, don't even try to flinch. Because for me, had there not been guns, I would have screamed. At least the police would have heard, and then they would have searched and realized I was being held against my will. But it was impossible, because had I done, they would have killed me. They would have killed everyone there. They had loads of guns in the car. Actually, sorry, Russell, before we got to the border, I just remember I forgot to mention something quite significant, which was...
Join me next time on The Stick Up as we continue Loretta Lyon's story, discovering how she escaped human trafficking to unite with her family. Her fight for freedom persists, and you won't want to miss it.